Today, Kiwis are cracking under the pressure, but the Reserve Bank of New Zealand says nothing to see here. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news. Well, we had important releases from Stats New Zealand and also the New Zealand Central Bank, which combined highlights a weird and unsettling cognitive dissonance. It was perhaps a matter of perspective, partly because the focus was on the financial system by the Reserve Bank, not individual households. But given the economy is so strongly connected to what households and businesses do, the stability report appeared to me unanchored from reality, especially given the prospects of higher rates for longer. And many of the themes that we're going to look at here are very relevant to other economies, including Australia. So Stats New Zealand reported that the cost of living for the average New Zealand household increased 6.2% in the 12 months to the March 2024 quarter. That's measured by the Household Living Costs Price Indices, the HLPIs. That follows a 7% increase in the 12 months to December, and the most recent high was 8.2% recorded in the 12 months to December 2022 quarter. Each quarter, the HLPIs measure how inflation affects 13 different household groups, plus an all-household group, which also is referred to as the average household. The HLPIs include interest payments, while the CPI includes just the cost of building a new home. For many households, interest payments have made a significant contribution to living costs, Stats New Zealand said. This reflects mortgage interest rates remaining high relative to 2021. In fact, interest payments increased 28% in the 12 months to the March 2024 quarter. Private transport supplies and services increased 9.6%, while insurance increased a massive 17.9%. The cost of building a new home increased just 3.3% in the same period. Other contributors to living costs for mass household groups were rent and, of course, petrol. This was followed by Statistics New Zealand recording larger than expected rises in unemployment and underemployment over the March quarter. New Zealand's unemployment rate rose by more than the consensus and the Reserve Bank expected in the first quarter to 4.3%, up 1.1 percentage points from the trough. Labour underutilisation also jumped higher. The jump in unemployment and underutilisation occurred alongside a 0.2% quarterly decline in employment and a large 0.6% fall in the employment to population ratio. And wage inflation pressure was also easing across New Zealand amid the loosening of the labour market. So all up, New Zealand's economy is sliding into a deepening recession. Overall GDP growth is falling, while per capita outcomes are collapsing amid a 2.7% surge in New Zealand's population in 2023. And per capita retail spending in New Zealand has collapsed, while New Zealand's consumer confidence is also falling after a short-lived post-election bounce. But turning to today's release from the Reserve Bank on financial stability and the subsequent press conference, while they did recognise that some were doing it tough, they also argued that this was a matter of bringing supply and demand back into balance, and there really wasn't much to see here.
New Zealand's financial system remains strong as it continues to adjust to the higher interest rate environment. Most mortgage holders have now repriced to higher mortgage interest rates as expected, and growing nominal incomes have assisted with that adjustment. However, we do acknowledge that some are doing it tough and having to reduce their spending and adjust their payment timetables to make ends meet. And this is occurring in an environment of heightened job insecurity, as highlighted by the labour market data this morning. Some businesses are also doing it tough. However, while non-performing business loans have risen, they've done so from still low base, and near-term risks to the agricultural sector have eased since our November report with the recent rise that we've seen in dairy prices. In other good news, global inflation is declining. However, from a financial stability perspective, there remains a risk that new or persistent inflation pressures could result in global interest rates remaining higher for longer, placing continued pressure on households, businesses, and the financial system. Supported by strong capital and liquidity positions, our assessment is that New Zealand's financial system remains well placed to handle a range of different severe scenarios as outlined in the report.
Now, interestingly, banks are extending and pretending to help mortgage households through, and as a result, default rates remain low, if rising a little.
Hi, Jenny Ruth from Good Returns and Just the Business. On the employment numbers today, one of the commentaries pointed out that unemployment is a lagging indicator. So we've got at least another year of deterioration ahead of us. The report says that currently mortgages that are in arrears are about 0.5% and that they could get to 0.7%. Is that upper end at risk from the outlook as we can see it from here?
So those projections for provisions that you outlined there are consistent with our projections for unemployment and the labour market and the broader macroeconomic outlook. So those things are consistent. That's the central case. You know, we have to bear in mind more severe scenarios as well. Chris, I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about how we put together our projections for provisions, but also maybe about the stress testing that we do as well to, you know, see how resilient the system is to other scenarios.
The point I was going to make and add there was, so the 0.7 you mentioned for non-performing loans is still a very manageable level for banks. So it's still low compared to what we saw after the global financial crisis, where I think the non-performing loan ratio for mortgages reached 1.2%. And it's still very low compared to what banks face in the stress test that we run. And as we've seen and talked about previously, the banks in those stress tests have proven that their resilience is there to actually very severe scenarios, much more severe than what we're looking at here.
And there are also two significant items to note. First, the bank is raising the issue of risk-based pricing for insurance, highly relevant given the average costs of insurance increased 17.9%.
Janae Tibshirani from The Herald. A few questions. Firstly, on insurance, if insurance insurers did start unbundling products, so have a carve-out, for example, that says if you're in a flood risk area, you cannot get flood cover, for example, how would that do you see that happening, and how would that bode with the comments you're making about banks keeping greater tabs on the insurability of properties that they lend against?
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for the question, and thanks for raising the special topic, which is a central part of our document. What it really is trying to highlight are these trends that we see into the future. So this trend for more risk-based pricing of insurance, and a potential trend that we see internationally of potentially unbundling risks and enabling those to be priced better. Our key, message is really just to understand that this is happening, for policy holders to get more information about why it is that their insurance is priced the way it is, what choices they have, what information that they can source to better understand the risk, to better improve their risk position so that they do get better pricing. For banks to, for insurers to be more transparent about the way that they're doing that, and for banks to have better data so that they're tracking whether a property is insured, not just at the time that the loan is undertaken, but through the life of the loan. So unbundling of risks is going to be part of that overall story, and that's something that lenders are going to have to understand in terms of the loans that they're providing to those property owners, the value of the collateral, and what different risks are in play through the life of the loan.
I mean, that whole situation would get quite complicated, presumably. Do you see a time in the foreseeable future where a bank goes, okay, you know, your interest rate is going to be a bit higher because you can't get adequate flood cover, and then you guys go, right, you need to hold more capital because of that risk? That sort of calculation will probably get quite confusing.
Well, our overall message is that, you know, risk-based pricing is potentially a positive development for financial stability in the long run, in the sense that if risks can be identified, if they can be priced well and allocated and managed to those best placed to manage them, that puts the financial system on a footing that when risks do occur, they're borne by the entity that's best placed to take that risk. The price signals that can come from risk-based pricing can be powerful in the sense of, you know, if there are risky areas of land to, you know, develop on, there should be a signal there, you know, pushing away that activity into less risky areas. So those price signals are going to become really important for decision-making.
Just finally, do you want to see banks use pricing, you know, more in this space? Like insurers are doing it with their risk-based pricing. Do you think there's room for banks to do that more when it comes to insurability, if you know what I mean? So charge you a higher interest rate if you have a property that is struggling to get insurance.
I think the message in the document is that the first step is a information gathering step. At the moment, we believe that banks have good information about the insurance cover at the beginning of the loan. They potentially don't have good information right through the life of the loan. So there's a first step there of gathering better information to be able to, so that they can understand the risks, price the risks, and then through, you know, and to manage the risks going forward, and that may incorporate some element of pricing.
But there will be consequences stemming from risk-based pricing, and it could well hit home prices in some areas.
Lucy from Reuters, going back to the climate change risks, are we seeing any changes in house prices given where locations are and what the impact might be, say, 10 or 15 years down the track? And what sort of risk does that pose to banks or the financial system, like going forward, if we're going to see houses in areas that are under risk kind of drop?
Yeah, maybe I'll ask Chris about whether we're seeing anything in the data so far. I think it's a very early discussion. It's something that we're raising awareness about because this is a development that we see, you know, moving further into the future. Risk-based price, you know, traditionally insurers have used what's called community-based insurance, which is, you know, spreading the risks right across the country, one area of the country effectively subsidising another area of the country, you know, most prominently in seismic risks. Different parts of New Zealand are exposed to earthquakes differently. Now they're introducing this more in terms of flood risks and other types of risks that they are insuring. So this is an early development. We see the more that they use risk-based pricing, the more that will flow into other things in terms of insurability and prices of houses as well. I think it's very early days in terms of whether that's occurring yet, Chris.
Yeah, I think we're still in the kind of process of developing and learning about these things, so getting data on that is something that's still being developed over time.
But how quickly do we need to kind of come ahead of this, given that if you're buying a house today, a beachfront property, you might be taking out a 30-year mortgage, and in 30 years that house might not actually exist?
That's one of the reasons that we're raising awareness now, because these risks do come forward. You see it, you know, across financial markets, the way that equity markets and commodity markets are constantly looking into the future and bringing back those risks to a price today. That's going to start happening in terms of pricing of insurance and therefore pricing of assets that are based on the reliability of insurance for those assets. What we're encouraging is, you know, to be part of that, if you're a stakeholder and part of that, to be part of the, you know, the work going forward and for property owners and policy holders. It means getting better information. It means looking at hazard maps. It means contacting the local council and understanding the hazards more in your relative area and your locality, which is going to give you some choices about what adaptation and mitigation you can start making now to reduce your risk in the future.
And during the press conference, possible changes to interest rates connected to insurance risks were mooted. And second, the proposed introduction of deposit insurance, which will come in next year, may shake up the sector, with perhaps higher risk players benefiting from the explicit government backing.
Janae from the Herald. A question about the deposit compensation scheme. This is maybe tangential to the report. I'm just wondering if you've done sort of a financial stability risk assessment around how the scheme might change the flow of deposits. So if, for example, I know that I can get my deposit insured if I put it in a finance company and get an extra couple of percent interest, I might be more inclined to do that than is currently the case, where I might just put my money in a bank. So I don't know. I suppose it might depend on how aware people are of the scheme. But is there, you know, a risk there if we see a bunch of money flow to these higher risk organisations that pay more interest?
So I'll hand over to Kate in a moment to talk a bit more about the deposit compensation scheme in general. But I think just a high level point that, which is useful to make, is that the deposit compensation scheme is coming in tandem with the Deposit Taker Act more generally, and that includes the different standards, the prudential policies that these deposit takers are going to be held to, such that they are part of the deposit compensation scheme. So I think that's part of the story. But Kate, do you want to expand?
Yeah, so deposit compensation scheme will come in middle of next year, covering up to $100,000 per depositor per eligible institution, as you highlighted. There could be a range of behaviours that occur off the back of that. I don't think we're expecting large change in terms of the deposits moving around, albeit people will make choices, and there's a range of reasons why people make choices where they put their deposits in certain places. In terms of, say, the levies that will be charged to institutions to build up the fund that would ultimately be used for any payout, there's mechanisms in there, for example, in our recent consultation on the levies related to risk-based pricing is what we have put out as our preferred approach. So the idea being higher risk entities are paying a higher proportion levy-wise, and that sort of somewhat provides some levelling there, you know, matching the risk and the pricing in terms of how that gets passed through ultimately in deposit rates potentially.
So that the differential will be smaller, I think, is what the paper says. Like, the difference between the finance company and the bank, the interest rate they pay will shrink. But I just wonder if you've done some scenarios that you could share with us around how money might be moved around. I don't know how much of an impact that could have.
Adrian, would you like to explain?
I was just prompting my colleagues. Just a scalar, the non-bank deposit taking scale is very small relative to the current deposit takers. The non-bank deposit takers will come in under our umbrella. They will have to meet prudential hurdles and standards and expectations so that these probabilities of failure are manageable and obvious to depositors on the way through. So it's about, you know, doing both at the same time, one providing the deposit compensation scheme, but at the same time trying to level the risk of these institutions, small with large, and make it very transparent. So that's, you know, that is the nature. We've seen enormous consolidation already in the non-bank deposit taking sector, and a lot of that is because of economies of scale, because of the future prudential challenges. The businesses aren't, especially strong. So we expect to see a far more level playing field and proportionality applied to our regulation of these small financial institutions.
But standing back, the Reserve Bank's financial stability lens seems to me to be a bit clouded, as the reality of a per capita recession and only nominal wage growth, together with higher unemployment, plays out. So I guess the question is, at what level does the pressure on households begin to show up in the financial system?
In the report, you talk about, I suppose, a kind of a gentle warning of risk around house prices becoming unsustainable, linked to the tax changes, to rising immigration, and the fact that you're not expecting, obviously, building to carry on once current developments are. How serious do you view that as a future risk?
Yeah, I'll ask Chris to talk a bit about some of the tax changes and the government changes, but in general terms, the housing market is not a large part of the story in this financial stability report, and the reason for that is that our assessment is that house prices are broadly sustainable now. When we look at across the different metrics we have, you know, that's a change in the story from when they were a long way north of sustainable level a year or two ago. So they are in that sustainable zone. That's one of the things that has motivated us under our recent consultation to ease our loan-to-value restrictions towards more neutral settings in conjunction with the introduction of a debt-to-income restriction. And we see some of the influences on the housing market being largely balanced at the moment in terms of higher immigration and less building weighed against the fact that interest rates remain high. But Chris, do you want to talk about some of the other implications, some of the other changes?
Yeah, so the thing I wanted to start on here is just referring back to our MPS projections for house prices, which basically have house prices increasing in line with income growth over the next couple of years. So pretty subdued in a sense. And that is kind of our central projection. Now, there's always going to be risks around that. And so in this report, we've highlighted there's a few things that are developing which suggests there could be a bit more pressure on the housing market as well. We've talked about there's the investor tax policy changes, which have potentially some impact. We've seen investors be pretty subdued in the market, their activity over the last two or three years, so could see a little bit more of that activity. And also you mentioned migration, particularly in a situation where new build activity is actually slowing as well. So there's those two are kind of a couple of things there. Which suggests, we're identifying there is that potential that you could see a bit more activity, and it's something we're watching.
Well, I suspect sooner rather than later, especially if those interest rates stay higher for longer, or indeed even go higher to quash inflation. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.